Cooney, reel 4.
Can you remember any incidents in which you were involved with him which might give me some indication of the kind of chap he was? Very often little stories work better than descriptions.
I don't think I can. I used to go over there, we were both chasing two sisters who lived in Manifold. We weren't very interested in military things in that way. But his chief claim to fame, I don't know whether it's worth putting on this, was that he had this company of 70 men, and when he joined, he said, "Who plays rugby football?" I don't know if you want to take this down or to cut it out. And one officer sheepishly half put up his hand. He said, "Well, that's grand. We will have a very good team. And now you'll all play rugby football, all 70 of you, and I will teach you how to do it." And he taught them in a barrack room, the blackboard, and matches on tables. And he allowed them to go out and do practices, passing and dropping kicks and goals and things like that. And they played their first match against us, Bovington here, in the very early spring, one of the first matches we had. And that year, that company was runner-up for the Army Championship against the Gloucestershire Regiment, 1,000 strong.
Good effort.
And he did it with absolute brilliance training. They played that game. The first game against them was quite undercountable. None of them were very good, but they never did the wrong thing. They always did the right thing. They didn't do it very well, but they always did the right thing, which is astonishing. Effect, you know.
Tribute to his skill as a training officer.
Absolutely. Yes. It was magnificent, you see, because they all knew exactly what ought to be done and how it ought to be done, although they weren't very good at doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I used that as a training instruction on several occasions and afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you must train your men, that they all should know exactly what they're trying to do, why and wherefore and how and all the rest of it. And then there might be some chance of them doing it.
Let's talk about some of these other personalities without worrying too much about the time in which you met them. Fuller was someone else who you came into contact with.
Yes, Fuller.
Yes.
I didn't meet him till later.
Mm-hmm.
When I came home from France on the 10th of November 1918, which was a very good time to come home from France, to a job at the War Office under Bernie Fuller. And I got to know him very well there. I worked for him.
Were your impressions of Fuller?
Fuller was the most brilliant mind, I think, that I've ever come across. A lot of people thought he was a little unbalanced, and that may be so. I don't know. I'm not in a position to sit in judgment on him. But he was a brilliant chap. The first time we went to see him on 11th of November 1918, he talked to me for a bit, and then he got up and he took down the book, it's there now, and he gave it to me, and he said, "This book will be far more valuable to you in your future as an officer than all the training manuals of the army." And it was Gustave Le Bon's Psychology of the Crowd.
How interesting.
And it's there now. And it was the most fascinating book, and it's still fascinating today.
One reads a lot in connection with Fuller about his capacity for upsetting senior officers. I wonder if that is a characteristic that you met.
The classic instance of that was the recruiting after the war for the regular army. And he was a little tiny man, about that high. And he wrote a paper on the policy which had governed recruiting. In the old days, it was a height standard. When you wanted recruits, you had to bring it down. When you were not so hard up, you put it up. And the theory was that big man was always better than little man, you see, and he went for this. He pointed out that all the great soldiers of history were all little men. Caesar and Napoleon and himself. And put it into General Lyndon Bell, who was then DSD, his peer, and Lyndon Bell, with a glint in his eye and a cigarette stuck between his lips, sent it on to Tiny Ironside to get his views. And that started a friendship, and indeed far more than a friendship, between those two. It went on. When Tiny Ironside went to the Staff College, he got Bernie Fuller as number two, and so on. And they stuck together, right? Very interesting. But he was a great... Bernie Fuller was a great man.
Do you remember any other incidents which give any insight into the kind of chap Fuller was?
Well, I've told you that one.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
And when he left, I went into his room just to make sure that he hadn't left any behind, and he had left an ordinary army notebook behind with aphorisms written in it. I had it for a long time, and I read to somebody, and it's gone. I've lost it. Wooden pencil. Some of them are very amusing.
Do you remember any of them?
Going up to the line yesterday, I came across dozens and dozens of dud shells that wouldn't explode. Coming back, I came across dozens of dud generals who couldn't explode, and this is why we're not winning the war. That sort of thing. And I told, I was a great friend of old Basil Littleheart too, and I told him a lot of these things. He was very interested.
Mm-hmm. What other people should we talk about? Ellis.
Hugh Ellis.
Is another important man.
I knew Hugh Ellis very well too.
Yes. Where did you meet him?
Well, he was commanding here, and I was his assistant staff. And when he went to Ireland and the troubles, he took me as his staff officer. We went all over Ireland in an armoured car. I got to know him very well indeed. Mm-hmm. He was a most exceedingly nice man, charming man, very theatrical. Mm. He was part of his stock in trade. Mm. The best story about him was that he, being down at Bovington, was the only chap who really knew anything about the tank. And the War Office used to send War Office files down to him to get his opinion. And they used to come into my tray, and I used to take them up to him. And I can remember one file, which I didn't even look at it. I mean, I took it straight up to him, and he took it home with him, and he brought it back. And he had written a minute in red ink. That was the time when Winston was the Secretary of State, and Winston said he was the only man who was going to use red ink in a War Office file. Here it was, written in red ink, addressed to the DSD or whoever it was. A lot of red blots underneath written, "Tears shed by me on reading the foregoing nonsense." Signed. And I said, "Sir, the War Office filed and no one's allowed to use red ink." He said, "Send it off, do what you're told, don't argue." And off it went.
Yes.
What happened, I don't know. But he was a... That was a good instance of his theatrical theatricality. Mm-hmm. But he was a very charming and very nice man. Mm. I liked him immensely.
Were there any other of these regular officers who were in at the very early stages of the tank who
yes,
you can remember?
Elliot Hotblack is one of the best. Have you ever heard of him? Mm-hmm. He was the intelligence officer. And he and I were good friends too. I was his assistant in the War Office after the war too. I think he's still alive. I keep on meaning to go and see, but I never get that far. But he's getting on now. Nobody's heard of him. He doesn't come to any dinners or anything. He used to, but he's getting on in years. He must be.
Any stories of Hotblack, contemporary ones?
Not really, no. I don't know any stories. He commanded the 2nd Armoured Division, but that was in the Second War. And I was his G2. And he was taking that expedition to Trondheim, and he got slugged or something. We had an office 30 in Eaton Square for 2 nights to tie up the final points. And he was in the office about 11 o'clock, and he went home to his flat.
One thing which interests me about these people is Little Heart, of course, is intimately associated with the early development of the tank, but he had an unusual position in that his was, after the war, an influence from outside rather than inside.
Oh, very much. Yes.
And I wondered to what extent his writings and his theories were, at this time, around the end of the First World War period, actually coming through to the army and having any influence on attitudes and practice.
I think he had a considerable influence on those who were converted, but he hadn't much influence on the heathen, if you know what I mean. He used to come down to Bovington. He used to have lunch with me very often when he came down to me. I knew him very well, right until the time he died. And a great deal of it was preaching to the wind. Of course, the chaps who swallowed it all were the Germans.
Hmm.
Guderian,
yes.
Was the chap who swallowed it all,
yes.
And produced it,
yes.
In the Second War.
Yes. During the First World War, was there any particular spirit or identity which developed amongst these early tank pioneers?
I don't think so, no.
No.
No, I think they just did their job, and I think they were all rather, rather proud of them. Of course, you see, the real trouble was that the army did not accept the tank in the way in which it could have been the best use.
Mm.
And Bernie Fuller and Hugh Ellis persuaded headquarters to try it out at Cambrai with no faith that it would work. And the result was they made a large hole in the German lines and nobody filled it, and then it was refilled by the Germans.
Yes.
But
yes.
It had the effect of convincing them that there was something in it. And then they were going to do it and going to do it, and the Boche got their blow in first on the 21st of March, and we nearly went into the sea. And then in August, on August the 8th, 1918, they did it. And the war was over in 12 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to your personal experiences, from which we have wondered, most interestingly, but wondered nonetheless. after Burmy Corps, where you did the technical part,
yes,
of your training, were you now fully trained on tanks as far as that was possible?
As far as it was possible to be.
Yes.
Except that we hadn't driven our tanks. Then we drew our tanks from Erin, and we did drive them about, I can't remember for how long, before we went up to the line.
Yes.
Which was on, we went up the line in April.
So there was a final phase in your tank training which involved driving the vehicle?
Yes.
That was at Erin,
I think it was. I'm not quite sure.
Erin is in Kent, isn't it? Erin is in Kent, isn't it?
No, in
Erith, I'm thinking.
No, no, Erin is in front of North France.
Ah, yes.
Yes.
Let's concentrate on this driving, on this operational training with the tanks themselves. If you wouldn't find this too dull to do, because I'd find it very interesting to hear, could you describe for me the number and functions of each member of the tank crew?
The tank in those days, the first tanks, had a crew of five. They all had an officer in it, who was the tank commander. They had a driver, who sat on his right. They had, no, six, I think. They had a gunner in each sponson, and they had a secondary gearsman. Sometimes, in fact, usually, very often, they worked in together and replaced each other. The whole process of driving those first tanks was quite complicated because they had to steer. They abolished the wheel, and then you steered where you had a throttle on each track. And then when you wanted a bit more, it had a gear on each track. And the secondary gearsman sat behind. And the noises were so much they couldn't hear what you said. And so you had the engine casing like that, and you took a big spanner and you hit the engine casing and signaled second gear to the chap. And so on. It was a very cumbrous way of turning and moving about. The gunners were either small arms, Lewis guns, or they were originally Hotchkiss, but then we switched over to the Lewis because they were easier to supply. And the 2-pounder gun.
Six-pounder gun.
Yes. 6-pounder gun. And they fired a solid shot. And they also fired a shell. And they fired a most frightful thing called grape. which was little bullets tied together with wire in a great cloud, and they fairly made a mess of people. I must confess, I thought they were very unfair. And then you had your signals, which were a flapper, a white flapper with Morse code, and an Aldous lamp. And we signaled back to a balloon, one of the balloon barrage balloons in the back, to get our message through by Morse. And we had pigeons, which you could send a message by. Very, very amusing stories told about... No, that's not relevant.